There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1096, May 26th. 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads that interest you. From tickets on the Orient Express to flights to Istanbul, Yahoo Ads gives you stuff you really want. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, as usual, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Norris wins strange and manipulated Monaco Grand Prix. Carlos Sainz says he doesn't like to race like this. Of course, Zach Brown thought it was the most exciting race ever. And Max says we might as well be driving Mario cars. Let me read about what Carlos Sainz said, and I quote, "Today is not how we want to go racing, and I think the way us and other teams were able to hold up the pace and build gaps shouldn't be what the Monaco Grand Prix is all about. We worked well as a team, but I understand the frustrations of the cars and everybody around us as we were victims ourselves." Alex Albon said, and I quote, "Today isn't how either Carlos or I want to go racing. It's not pretty, but in the end, it was a tactical game and we had to make it work. The Racing Bulls did it first, and we knew if they started it, we had to begin." And so there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, an exciting Grand Prix in Monaco, because I like Monaco. I like the ambiance. I like the whole surroundings of it all. But adding this second stop because of what happened last year with the red flag, and of course under a red flag everybody gets free tire changes, and everybody went to the end of the race without a pit stop. It was so processional, and what we got this time was not only processional, but bizarre and manipulated by teams slowing other teams down by over 6 seconds. So it was a slow race, manipulated race, and in the end, it didn't change anything. The top qualifiers finished where they began, and I was pleased for Hajar, of course. He was elated. Liam Lawson in the points, Carlos and Albon, it worked. The manipulation brought them into the points. Of course, Russell having the complete failure of the Mercedes package in qualifying put him and Antonelli having a crash in 14th and 15th. So when you start back there, but everybody talked about how the back markers, if they pit first, go long, and pit again strategically, they might have a shot at the top 10, which never materialized. The whole idea, theoretically, was just not a great idea. Throwing more pit stops at a track where really the biggest problem is the cars are too big. Smaller cars, more overtaking, more fun, more adventure. So hopefully 2026 cars will maybe solve some of these issues, but that was really, really hard to watch. I mean, I'm not going to lie. And I love Monaco. And I admit, I did want Leclerc to win, but even with DRS, the DRS in the straight, the start straight, it completely non-functional, because if you charge your batteries, you get the boost, you can beat the DRS, and there was just no way Leclerc, even though I have to admit, Max slowing up the field at the end, giving Leclerc a bit of a shot, and him waiting till the last lap, because he had to go on the softs, and they're only good for one lap, maybe not even that much, three quarters of a lap. It was interesting, but certainly not a great spectacle to watch when you want to go racing. And maybe we should redefine racing in Formula One. Because for me, that was a very big disappointment from the beginning to the end. And there was just no thrills. I mean, and of course, Max was hoping, praying for a red flag, but everybody went in very, very conservative. I mean, I was completely off base saying that Colapinto would crash because he just simply never went fast. And that's the new trend. We're not really racing. It's sustainability through the Grand Prix. Yes, dynamics. Strategic slowing down now. Saving fuel? No, not even. So, I don't know. I'm looking forward to the Indy 500, but I don't have time to wait for that because I'm still in France and there's a 9-hour difference. But let's hope that that is not as boring as this was. And I shouldn't use the word boring because I love Monaco. It still is the jewel. And I believe that Monaco needs F1, F1 needs Monaco. So I want this to stay on the calendar. So let's hope the new cars will maybe bring a new beginning, because for me that was pretty tough to watch. But I'm happy for Piastri. Finishing third means he's still the leader in the championship. Norris is now second, 3 points behind. And I don't know, Max is still in it as well. George suffered the most being out of the points. They really had a hard time. And of course, Fernando. Is he the más macho del mundo? I mean, it's such a terrible season for him. And he qualified so well. But he had a power plant issue, and it was just a tragedy to watch. And of course, Lawrence Stroll's little Jim Clark was a disaster, piling up penalties from barring or blocking people. Even Hamilton had a penalty, but Max and Lewis shook hands, and everything was copacetic. But really, a very strange race to watch. I was quite shocked over the whole thing. But once again, Monaco is always an interesting, it's not political, but there's just something about it that just doesn't work right now. And once again, I'm hoping the 2026 cars really help with that. They'll be smaller, narrower, and I hope they're fast. But there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That was absolutely very interesting. I'm over the moon for Hajar, really the rookie that I think is really doing well. And I was very impressed with the pace of the Racing Bulls. Very impressive, almost better than Tsunoda. And let's not forget, Tsunoda, with this kind of two-stop strategy, we were hoping he would leap forward in some kind of strange strategic manipulation. But that never occurred. Of course, Gasly running into the back of him, I was just stunned that he was able to finish the Grand Prix. So I thought the Gasly crash was very bizarre. I thought it was interesting how Russell would cut the chicane and said, "The hell with it, I'll take the penalty." And then they were talking about Max not taking the second pit stop, because apparently they said that that would just be a 30-second penalty, and he had enough time to absorb the penalty, but in the end, we all found out that he would be disqualified not taking the pit stop. So, interesting. Everybody finished in the same place. You got to give it to Norris for putting it all together. The McLaren was fast. He has the lap record now, under 70 seconds. It doesn't get more exciting than that in terms of qualifying for Monaco. And really, for me, Saturday is Monaco. And Norris nailed it. Leclerc was definitely beating himself, trying too hard, perhaps, because if you look at the lap times and the drivability of each car, it was really about driving intelligently and not overdriving the car, especially in the middle stint. So kudos to McLaren, of course, and even Piastri. He said he hit the walls more that weekend than in his entire career. So it was fun to watch because I love Monaco. The weather was fantastic. The people watching was fantastic. And I could not believe Martin Brundle actually wore a suit for the grid walk. Of course, he always talks to the silly people. I'm not sure what's going on there, but still a wonderful race, just bizarre, and it's certainly manipulated. So there you have it. Let's hope that Barcelona is exciting. Of course, that Grand Prix is fading away. It's not on the calendar next year, but it's a classic. It's windy, and anything could happen. We could be going back to a more modern, normal Grand Prix next weekend. So everybody enjoy it. Of course, this week's classics, classic Nasser Hamid, is his conversation with Derek Walker, team owner and during Champ Cars, IRL. Of course, he was Bernie's when Bernie owned Brabham. Derek Walker was his mechanic. So he's got good stories to talk about. This is a wonderful interview. And once again, Nasser hits it out of the park. So enjoy that. Enjoy the week ahead. Everybody enjoy the Indy 500. And don't forget, Nasser, I think about you every day. Good night. Welcome to the studio, Nasser. How are you today?
Very good, sir. Thank you. And racing regards to all the listeners out there.
So there you have it. You know what? We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with all sorts of good stuff.
Hello, this is Andrew with this week's F1Weekly.com trivia question. The FIA recently issued a discussion paper concerning the 2011 regulations. And one of the proposals is to bring back turbocharged engines. So here's a turbo question for you. Who is the first driver to become world champion powered by a turbocharged engine? And I'll give you a clue. It was in 1983. Was it Alain Prost, Nelson Piquet, Jean-Pierre Jabouille, or Niki Lauda? I'll be back later in the show with the answer.
Welcome back to F1 Weekly. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, since the Hungarian Grand Prix is history, we are going to have some history of the Hungarian Grand Prix. Nas?
Hello, everybody. How are you? Okay, Clark, what we're going to do is just talk about some of the memorable Formula One races in Hungary. History of motor racing in Hungary goes back to the golden age of Grand Prix racing, the pre-war years. This was the time when, you know, they would do a lot of races around the streets and parks in places like, apart from Hungary, Czech Republic and Switzerland. As Desiree mentioned on Saturday's show, the only pre-war Hungarian Grand Prix was held in 1936 and won by the flying Mantuan, Signor Tadzio Nuvolari, in an Alfa Romeo. Today we will look at some of the most memorable Magyar moments since the first Formula One race at Hungaroring in 1986. Did you watch that race in 1986?
Nope.
Okay, I did. In those days it was a communist country and about a crowd of almost 200,000 comrades showed up for the race, and the boys of Brazil did not disappoint them. And I was very excited what happened. Ayrton Senna started from pole in his Lotus, with man from Rio, Nelson Piquet, alongside him on the front row in his Williams. They finished in reverse order, and folks, those who have not seen, you have to see the pass Piquet made on Senna to believe it. This is, in my opinion, the second greatest pass in Formula One history that I have watched. First one being the Nigel Mansell on Berger in Mexico. And the beauty about this pass was Piquet had tried it one time. Senna left him no room and his car was slipping and sliding. And on the very next lap, again, Senna left him no room. Oh, what a surprise that was. And it was like watching a dirt race, you know. On a dirt track, his car was slipping and sliding. But second time around, he was managed to pass Ayrton Senna. And if you watch it on YouTube, you will really appreciate it. Piquet also won at Hungaroring in 1987. And Clark, I'm assuming you have seen this pass that I'm talking about.
Yes, I have. Okay. I have seen it. But I didn't see it in 86.
Okay. Pièce de résistance for you?
Absolutely.
Good. Senna won the race in 1988, but was the victim of a great maneuver in 1989, this time by Nigel Mansell. The Il Leone started from 12th on the grid in his Ferrari, and with less than 20 laps from the end, surprised Senna as they came to pass Stefan Johansson in his Onyx. And I remember Senna in the interview said that today the best man won. It was just a very lightning quick reflex on Mansell's part and, you know, took the lead. The following year, Senna tried everything to win but was unable to pass Thierry Boutsen in his Williams, perfect example of the difficulty of passing at the Hungaroring, the Belgian driver winning by 0.3 of a second. Close finish, and Senna was all over, just couldn't pass him. And Senna had back-to-back wins in 1991 and 92, and all of Senna's victories here, three, came when he was with McLaren. Our man Damon Hill in the Yamaha-powered Arrows almost made history in 1997. This was the only time I was pulling for Damon Hill to win a race because it was with Arrows and Yamaha. That year he dominated the race, which included passing Michael Schumacher in his Ferrari in an Arrows.
That's impressive. Unbelievable.
Exactly. But lost the lead to Jacques Villeneuve with less than three laps to go due to a hydraulic glitch. Arrows and Yamaha both came and went from the world of Formula One without ever winning a race. So sad, but so true. And talking of your favorite driver, Michael Schumacher, the modern-day Red Baron, he was victorious in Hungary four times, 1994, 98, 2001, and 2004. His 1998 win is regarded as one of his best. With no chance of winning, Ross Brawn radioed Michael to switch to a three-stop strategy and instructed qualifying times in the race. The German hardly disappointed on race day, and this was no exception. Do you remember watching this race?
Yes, I did watch this
race. I was like very stunned.
Exciting, very impressive.
Stunned. I was like, so, wow.
Classic Ross Brawn strategy.
Yeah. Can you say something about the driving also?
It was pretty good.
Oh, thank you. Dankeschön. Okay, in 2003, 22-year-old your hombre Fernando Alonso became the youngest Grand Prix winner ahead of 23-year-old Kimi Raikkonen and 27-year-old Juan Pablo Montoya, making this the youngest podium in F1 history. And Clark, when this race took place, I was in beautiful downtown Karachi, and I watched the race live with my old buddies. And because of the time difference, it was like at 6 o'clock in the evening, not like 5 in the morning. So a little personal reflection on the 2003 Hungarian Grand Prix. The long-awaited maiden win for our gents last year was also the first win for Honda since the 1967 Italian Grand Prix. Hamilton's win on Sunday is 50th win for the McLaren-Mercedes partnership, DC being David Coulthard, giving them their first win in Melbourne in 1997. The Hungaroring is the second slowest circuit on the calendar after Monte Carlo, which is very easy to figure out. And again, your man, Michael Schumacher, holds the lap record there, 1 minute 19.071 from 2004. And folks, that's the goulash on Hungarian Grand Prix.
Keep up the good work, Nass. Thank you for that finely stirred goulash. You know what? I want to hear a little bit more of the Alonso-Hamilton feud.
Yeah, what happened, I was looking at, you know, this news is all over town. So I was looking at the website planetf1.com, And here are some of the postings on that website. One guy writes, whatever pressure he feels, Alonso, he's under pressure to produce a third successive world championship title. There is no excuse for what he did. Next guy writes, we are going back to the old Senna Prost McLaren era, which is the common theme with a lot of people. And one guy writes, Alonso is a cheat and a bad sport. I will never support Alonso in racing ever again. I guess you won't be sending him a F1 Weekly t-shirt, right?
I wonder what this guy said about Michael Schumacher.
Yeah. Well done, Lewis. This is another posting. Well done, Lewis, for staying so calm for the press conference. Alonso knows he's up against a better driver. And the next email is my favorite take on this whole situation. Alonso's move as bad as Schumi's Monaco stunt. And that's what I feel. It was really pathetic. On a lighter note, I don't know if you – did you see the practice session on Friday?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Kimi Raikkonen was interviewed on TV and was asked by Peter Windsor, I like a man who speaks his mind.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to agree with what he's saying, but at least, you know, it's face value. Peter Windsor asked him if he enjoyed having his mother and grandmother at the European Grand Prix. And Kimi being Kimi, this is what he says. No, you know women, they talk too much. End of quote.
Yeah, he's pretty sophisticated, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they were talking about what he did for his grandma's 80th birthday. Most people take their grandmother on their 80th birthday to IHOP, leave it to Kimi, who hopped in a go-kart with grandma to take her for a ride.
I think that's a beautiful story.
I'm surprised he didn't ask Paul Stoddart for a two-seater Minardi.
He should have.
Grandma would have a lot of fun at 150 miles per hour.
Yeah, but I'd let her drive.
Oh, yeah.
I bet you she's quick.
Well, I think that some of her genes are in Kimi.
Keep up the good work, Nass. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with some fantastic emails and more goodies in the box.
Emails!
Want to find out how much you know about Formula One? Are you interested in learning more about Formula One's history? Then have a listen to the Formula One Trivia Podcast, a weekly 10-question trivia quiz that will test your knowledge. Visit the website at www.f1triviapodcast.com to find out more.
Nass, and now I want you to introduce this interview because this man is a legend in motorsports.
Well, Clark, this interview is with Derek Walker, who's team principal of Walker Racing, who are now in Champ Cars Racing as Team Australia. With Simon Pagenaud from your spiritual hometown and Will Power from Australia. I'll tell you, these are the kind of people that I can sit down and talk for 24 hours nonstop. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. His story, he is originally from Scotland, and when he was young, family moved to Australia, and that's where he saw his first race. Then he moved back to Scotland and got a job with the racing outfit in London and worked for Brabham when it was owned by Bernie Ecclestone. So I talked to him about Bernie as a person, as a boss. Fascinating story there. And he was chief mechanic to Carlos Alberto Reutemann. And I asked him if he was there when he won his first Grand Prix in South Africa, a race I remember very well, 1974, a long time ago. And he was telling me how the day was. And he said the best win for him in Formula One was when Reutemann won the German Grand Prix at Nürburgring, you know, over 14 mile. And it's just incredible. You know, he was also the team owner when Willie T. Ribbs became the first African-American to qualify and race at Indy, 1991. And I was part of that program with Willie T. So just a very nice conversation. And we ran out of time. And this was conducted at the San Jose Champ Car Grand Prix, which is only a few miles from executive offices of F1 Weekly. And I said to Derek, man, you know, I really enjoyed this. Can we do this conversation some other time? He says, no problem, anytime you want. And his PR lady, Elizabeth Cannon, is a very friendly lady, and she had arranged interview last time with Simon Pagenaud when they were testing at Laguna Seca. So we have sort of a good, you know, rapport with the team there now, and I would love to sit down and talk more about motor racing with Derek Walker in the near future. And I hope people listen to it and enjoy it as much as I enjoy talking to him. Thank you.
Very good. We'll call this the first volume of an interview with Derek Walker.
Okay, I'm at the San Jose Grand Prix with Derek Walker, boss man of Walker Racing. Derek, you are from the land of Jim Clark and Jackie Stewart, but your interest in motor racing was sparked by in Land Down Under. Please tell us about your early days growing up in Australia, and how did you catch the racing bug?
Well, I lived in a very small town outside of Perth called Northam. And one morning there was a lot of noise outside the street, at the end of the street, and it turned out to be a street race, one of the early street races. And I was probably around, five maybe. So the noise and the speed of the cars was enough to capture my imagination. I said, that's what I got to do. And several years later, I managed to fulfill my dream.
Was there any interest in motor racing in your family?
None whatsoever, no. My uncle was a mechanic, a car mechanic, so, he helped point me in the direction because I got into racing through mechanicking. But that was the only connection.
What was the first major motor racing event you remember being at, and how old were you then?
Well, it would be in that street race in Australia, and as I say, I was about five. It was a local organized race, and it ran around the streets of Northam.
You have devoted all your life to motor racing. Did you ever try your luck and talent behind the wheel like Colin Chapman and Enzo Ferrari?
No, I don't know if I could even put my name alongside them, let alone drive the cars. I have much more modest goals for myself, which would be just to do what I'm doing now, which is to have my own business and my own race team.
Now, this is according to your website. You celebrated your 21st birthday with your first job in racing. Can you please tell us something about that job and who are some of your customers?
Well, actually, what happened was when my family brought us back from Australia, I got a job in a huge big bus company. And so I served an apprenticeship for 5 years as a bus mechanic. And on the day I was 21, I had a job down in London for a small company called Cortune, who used to prepare people's race cars, amateur racers. And so I had a job with them. So the day I was 21, I loaded up my Mini and drove down to London and took my first job in racing.
All the way from Scotland?
Yeah, all the way. Yeah, it took about 7 hours, I believe.
Wow. Now, you were working for Brabham Formula One team when it was bought out by a very nice man by the name of Bernard Ecclestone. What was your experience working for Bernie?
Well, Bernie is... we didn't think about it at the time, but obviously since then we've realized that he was and still is a very unique and special kind of person. So Bernie really didn't come over as a real aficionado of racing. He'd been around racing, but he just seemed to be very good at picking people and getting them to do the job of running and developing the race cars. So, in those days, Gordon Murray was a designer, and we had Carlos Reutemann and Carlos Pache and Graham Hill before that. And so, Bernie seemed to be really good at doing the business and picking the people, and he left us alone. And so he was really a good person to work for. I enjoyed it and learned a lot from him.
Now, he was manager to, if you remember, a driver named Stuart Lewis Evans. He was here in the Moroccan Grand Prix 1958. And he was also manager to Jochen Rindt in 1970. Mm-hmm. Apart from being a racing person, how was he as a non-boss?
He's not a very complicated person. At least I didn't find him that way. He's very straightforward. He's a stickler for detail. He likes everything clean and tidy and neat. And suffers fools lightly. He doesn't have a lot of time for people that he thinks are just, fools,
When he says 30 million to Tony George, it means 30 million.
He probably said, Tony, watch my lips, 30 million. Yeah, Bernie's one of the cleverest, smartest businessmen. Like him or like him not, he's one of the smartest businessmen around. He's, in my opinion, he made Formula One what it is today. When I was in it, before Bernie came on the scene as a team owner, it was very much an amateur. It was a lot of egos that didn't make a lot of money but loved to go racing. And Bernie came in and really transformed it into the mega franchise that it is today. And I think people probably think it's time for a change, but I think they will regret ever wishing that, because I think the minute somebody else takes over from Bernie, I think you'll find quite a different business model in Formula One, and one that will perhaps go out of control. It's too big, and it needs a benevolent dictator and somebody who knows everything about it, and they don't find Bernie Ecclestone's on every street corner.
No, I don't agree with everything he does or says, but I have a lot of respect for what he has done. Are you surprised how powerful he has become in Formula One?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, in the days when he came into Formula One, he didn't show a lot of, like, desire to go out and build a mega franchise. He very rarely talked about what he was doing anyway. He's a very quiet and secretive kind of a guy. And that's very smart. But, you know, I haven't seen over, you know, once he got involved and he didn't use his race team but started organizing the series, then you could see that he was going to take it somewhere. But I'm sure even he didn't dream that it could ever be this big. But, you know, Bernie's a smart guy. Maybe he had it all planned out all along and he just didn't tell us.
How good was Gordon Murray? He designed some of the most beautiful cars, I have to say.
I think one of the best designers in Formula One. I think the only pity about Gordon is he stopped designing Formula One cars. I think I would love to have seen him continue on, because when you look at the really brilliant designers, the ones that were really creative and who had ideas, different ideas, and really set trends, I think Gordon was very much in that mold. He was a really super nice guy to work with, very practical person in design and his whole approach. Yeah, he's a real gem. It was more luck than judgment that Bernie found him. Gordon was shuffling around in the drawing office at Brabham's as a lad, doing a lot of detail work for the designers of those days, which was Ralph Bellamy, I believe I remember. And Gordon was just an assistant, and nobody really gave him a second look. He looked like long hair, and he used to drive a funny little Mini he used to bring to work that he designed himself. A really weird kind of character. And once we on the team, we really saw what Gordon could do, because he would take some of the projects he's got and really design them really well. And Bernie gave him a shot at designing a car and chose which car he was going to use. It was either Ralph Bellamy car or it was going to be a Gordon Murray. And Gordon won the contest, and that was the Toblerone car, as we used to call it, and the Martini Brabhams. And those were fantastic, very, very simple, good cars.
And the beautiful Martini red and blue paint scheme. I love that paint scheme.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Later on, it changed to the red. Yeah, red and blue. Yeah. No, he's a brilliant guy. I think he could design anything he puts his mind to it.
You mentioned two Carloses in your team. Carlos Pasci was unfortunately killed in a road plane crash. And the other, Lole, Carlos Reutemann, was one of my all-time favorites. What memories do you have of him and his lovely wife, Mimicha?
Well, you know, Carlos was a steely, quiet, deep kind of a person. He made driving look effortless. You know, he didn't really look like he was really trying all the time. I worked as his chief mechanic for I think 5 years of the time he was there at Brabham, something like that, and maybe 4 years. And he was just great. You know, he knew how to drive a car, and he was naturally talented. And him and his wife, they traveled everywhere with the team and became part of the family. And rather surprised he's ended up as a politician, because, you know, in those days, Carlos didn't really want to be bothered by anything. So I imagine he's got plenty on his hands now in Argentina. But in those days, you never saw that in him. He was just a very quiet, deep, passive kind of person, driver who just loved racing.
Were you there at Kyalami in 1974 when he scored his first Grand Prix win?
Yes, I was.
What was that day like for you and him?
Oh, for the whole team, it was brilliant. Yeah, just, you know, it was only a matter of time as far as we were concerned. It was coming. I think the most memorable win that I really took the most pleasure out was winning the Nürburgring. That was always the mega race to win. You know, it's 14 miles around, and you know, in those days, you'd send the car off, and you sat down, had sandwiches, and had drinks, and about 7 minutes later, if you're lucky, the car would come round again, and it was one of those unusual. So it was such a challenging racetrack that to win that race, you were considered a master driver. You know, you were considered a real champion driver, and Carlos won it there, and we had a really good time celebrating that.
You know, since you know the man so well and work with him, I have a question for you. You know, the last Grand Prix where he lost the championship in Vegas, which I believe was 1981, he was on pole. You know, what you read in the media, you may not always think it's the right thing. They always say he was moody, he had an off day. But was it a problem with the car? What happened? I mean, you just can't fade away so easily.
Well, I wasn't there at that time, so I don't know exactly. Carlos could be moody, I guess you could call him moody, sulky, a little bit sultry. But I always thought he gave 100%. If the car was good enough, he would drive it. But I don't honestly know what happened then.
Have you kept in touch with him and Bernie?
I've kept in touch with Bernie. I occasionally contact him and beg for a Formula One pass so I can get in and see these things again and say hello to him. Carlos, I have not spoken to Carlos almost since I left Brabham's, or since I left Penske's, actually.
Now, there were some great drivers in that era, Ronnie Peterson, Niki Lauda, and the Kimi Raikkonen of the day, James Hunt. Did you get to know some of those drivers personally?
We would know them so much as enough to say hello and make casual conversation. I didn't, you know, teams tended to have the teams in those days were very small and had so much work to do that the mechanics were always working all the time on getting these cars to work. So you didn't spend a lot of time socializing with other drivers, but you were around them and you knew them and you could, you know, you talk to them casually as you do. So you knew what they're all about, and obviously, more importantly, you raced against them. So you knew their character, and you could rate them accordingly.
From your time in Formula One, are there any drivers who were not with Brabham that you liked or were decent guys or you wish they had more success than they achieved?
Well, I think certainly Peterson was a talent that didn't spend enough time in racing. It was cut short. I think there's many, many drivers that have come through Formula One that you look at. Chris Amond, I always used to think, was a special driver and, again, sort of very underrated at times. Lots of them, but certainly at Brabham's, we had some good ones with the two Carloses. They were brilliant, and we enjoyed them a lot.
Were you at Sweden 1978 with the Brabham fan car?
No, I was not. I had left. I left by then. No, I was no longer there. I was very much. Well, again, Gordon, you know, if you look at what he did, what he designed, he created a lot of new ideas and you know, really creative guy. And it's a shame he stopped designing race cars, because I think we could have seen some real talent there that would have generated. I think very much in the mold of Colin Chapman. Very much in the same mold. I mean, I think Gordon was perhaps, well, I think for sure he was a simpler designer. When you look at Gordon's designs, there were very, very few parts of very straightforward cars. Collins tended to be very technically very smart, very fragile, and somewhat complicated in places, but, you know, beautiful cars. I think one of the all-time great designers of all time was Chapman, and the people that worked with him that he infected by his enthusiasm. And certainly, as you started talking originally in this interview, the Jim Clark, the all-time favorite of mine, was you know, great Lotus driver.
Talking of Penske, you were with Penske for over a decade. How would you compare the captain with Bernie, both of whom were very successful?
Well, there's similarity as probably only in so much that they're both very determined guys, and They're not complicated people. They're very straightforward in what they try to do. Roger is a lot more of a technocrat when it comes to racing than Bernie was. Roger knows both sides of the race team, the business side and also the technical side, and has an influence over what happens. Both are very very astute businessmen and tend to have very small organizations. They don't have a lot of layers of management. They deal very much hands-on. But quite different personalities, but two of the most successful guys in racing ever, I think. I think I learned different things from both of them. And so,
given his businesses and vast interests he has, how does Roger find time to be at every race? You know, he's on a stock car race, a dirt race, and IndyCar race. How does he find time to do that?
Well, he probably doesn't have any private life to talk of. He's a racerholic, let's put it that way, and a businessaholic. But I think that's what makes him so good. He's very current. He's not one of those guys who sits back. He's very much hands-on, very much there. And, that's what's given him the longevity and the success, is just the amount of time and effort he puts into it. And Roger Penske's probably the strongest when he's behind. When he's in the hole and fighting to get back up to the front, that's when he's his most formidable. Because he just pulls out all the stops, and he's a ferocious... he has a ferocious appetite for winning, and so he'll pull it back there sooner or later. And it's not all about mega dollars. It's about the approach, the focus that he puts on it, and how much he inspires all of his people that work for him to pull out whatever it takes to make it successful.
When you were at Penske, your team won 5 Indy 500s. Which one was the most memorable for you?
Well, it's a funny thing. Any time we won a race or a championship, I never, because it was Roger's team, I never really felt that I won anything. I was a servant to the captain, and it was his race team, and it was his win. So I never really, it was kind of an odd feeling, but I never really felt like any of them meant anything till the car that I was running on a particular day in 85 with Danny Sullivan, and we won the race, and I felt like this was a little bit of my race, so that one probably means the most.
Now, when he spun, okay, the race was not televised live, but when you look at it in replay, when he was spinning, were you surprised that he kept going and did not hit the wall?
Well, the funny thing is we were looking for a yellow because we wanted to make a pit stop, so we were hoping a yellow was coming up. And he misread the signboard, if I recall, and thought there was less laps in the race than there was. So he started to speed up and tried to run harder and harder. And I was quite surprised that his lap times picked up. And he was tracking down Mario, and he was going after him. And then he spun. But, of course, we couldn't see the spin. We didn't know what had happened. It just went yellow, and I shouted on the radio, "It's yellow, yellow, yellow." And he came back to me and said, "It's me, it's me, it's me, I'm okay, I'm okay." And I looked around to the guys in the pit, and I said, "What did he say?" You know, I couldn't believe what he said. I said, "No, come on, pit this time. So he come running in. We did the pit stop, and he went back out. And Dan Luganbill was a PR guy for Roger Penske. He was in the other pit with Roger, and he come bounding down to me, and he says, "You won't effing believe this," he said. And Sullivan just did a 360 and carried on, and he's okay. And I said, yeah, okay, Dan, all right, because we were like too busy keyed up on the race. And I never really sunk in until later on in the garage afterwards they saw the replay of the race, and I was like amazed.
So you did not even know till after the race what had happened.
Sullivan came on the radio and said, "Well, I spun, I lost it, and I got it. It's okay." When he was on the yellow, he told us about it. But you couldn't visualize that he spun it round and then came. Of course, then it went green again, and he went right down into the corner again with Mario again, exactly the same way, and he completed the pass, and the rest was the milk, right?
Yeah. It would have been orange juice if it was Fittipaldi. Question, Denny Sullivan is a great American success story. He went from driving a cab in New York to from a gopher to a Grand Prix driver with Tyrrell. How was he to work with as a driver and as a person?
As a person, I always found him very charming, very friendly, and I bonded with him quite well. Danny as a racer was surely a better road course racer than he was an oval guy. But, you know, somebody who had, at the time, he had is one of those drivers who brought in a little bit of showbiz and a bit of racing. You know, he had a skill in driving, and he brought a lot of Hollywood types. So it was always, there was always an entourage around Danny, and there was always a fuss. So he brought that sort of Hollywood sparkle to racing that, you know, I think as time's gone on, you know, racing has got a little bit more commercially minded and how to appeal to more than just the racing nut. And I think Danny was very much that way. And we joked with him one time, in his locker in the truck, we put a row of stars around the mirror inside his locker, meaning, you know, Hollywood. And that was one of our nicknames for him, is Hollywood, because he was, you know, it's almost like, shall I be a race driver or shall I be a movie star? Well, he tried to do the movie bit and it didn't work, so he ended up a race driver, and that was this.
Now, some of the big, very big names in Champ Car, IndyCar Racing have raced for your team or the teams you were with, Rick Mears, Alan Bobby Unser's. I've always thought of Rick Mears as the best oval racer this country has produced. What made him so special, especially at Indy?
Well, the best race best oval race driver, you know, it's like Colin Chapman with Rindt or Mario Andretti. You know, when you compare drivers, they come out of different eras, and it's very hard to actually compare them. So I think you only rate them in the era that they raced. And certainly of the young lions coming along in the late 70s, Rick was a very special, and you're right, a very good oval racer. He made it look easy, as all the good ones do. He was a calculating, very patient driver, very you know, he'd never get rattled, he'd never get angry. Very rarely did you ever see Rick Mears get angry. He was a gentleman, and people loved to work for him. He gave 110%, and you know, his record shows how good he was.
Talking of rattle, Bobby Unser has been rattling a few cages lately in the last few years. I'm sure you've heard of him in the news. How was he? I've spoken to a few other people, and they thought he was quite a project. What was your take on him?
Well, if Bobby was here, I'd probably say in front of him that he was a bit of a head case. Now, Bobby was different, for sure. He didn't quite like me when he first got involved with Penske's and I was there. He wasn't quite keen on me, maybe because I didn't go along with everything that he was wanting. And he used to like... the fact that Rick was just a kid, and Rick Mears didn't get anything special. He got everything special. So he always liked to see Rick Mears in number two spot and him in number one. And, of course, as Rick got better, so he started winning, and Bobby was, you know, towards the end of his career. And I was team manager, so I favored both drivers, but I didn't want to have any one of them be more dominant. So Bobby and I had a bit of a contest as to who was going to be king in the team, because he liked to have things all his way. But, you know, underneath all of that, he is a driver from a different era, but a very intelligent driver, very smart driver. He technically would, given the era and given the tools and the knowledge of what racing cars were, he was a very technical driver, and he would take things and change things, and always looking for an advantage by the developing the car. He used to drive the engineers mad because he'd want to do a lot of engineering, and a lot of weird ideas would come out of it. But, you know, in through it all, he was a very... very smart guy, and as time went by, we learned to appreciate each other, and now we're real good friends, and we often laugh about some of the things that happened back then. But Bobby was quite unusual.
I'm a huge Formula One fan, but if there is one race finish that I compare to any Formula One race, is the 1982 Indy 500 last six laps. Were you there?
Well, it was my car that nearly won the race. My car was the second car. It was a strange day. That was my second year IndyCar back then. It was my second race and as a team owner. And we started almost last because we had an engine problem for qualifying, so we had to change the engine, and that meant we had to start at the back of the grid. So we got another driver to qualify one car that we put Scott in, which was a bit further up the grid, and then the next weekend we qualified his car and swapped drivers. And so he had to start at the back, and it was a very cold day. Tire temperatures weren't coming up, and because we were starting at the back, we were a little slower to get up to speed because you had to follow all these other cars. And I think that really gave us an advantage. After about a couple of crashes, we said on the radio, there's something wrong here. These tire temperatures are not coming up. So, you know, we got to be more careful with it. And Scott really was smart about it, and he drove it all the way up to the front, and we lost by a nose or whatever. It was bittersweet in a way, given that how much had gone on to finish the race in second was I was pleased as punch. But when you sat down on the pit wall after and said, "Gee, I could have won this thing," you felt a little bit cheated because we didn't get it done.
How does a team and a driver come back from such a big letdown? Not losing the Indy 500 has got to be a huge, huge disappointment.
Well, I think if you're involved in racing, you realize very early on there's only one winner. So you better get used to it because there's no chance you're going to win every race. So whether you're a team guy or a driver or a team owner or whatever, you learn to focus on what it's going to take to win. So when you don't win, then you look and say, well, what could I have done differently? What do I need? And did I do enough? Did I get enough out of what I had? And then you focus on that. So you really got to be very hard about, strong-willed about what you want, and realize that the best guy wins, usually. And if you didn't win, there's probably some stuff you need to do, you need to work on. And so no point in sitting there crying. You might as well figure out, sooner you get up and get after it, the sooner you might be able to win. So it's simple as that.
As Mr. Chapman used to say, if you're not winning, you're not trying harder, right?
Well, that's right. That's exactly right, yeah. And as Mr. Roger Penske says, effort equals results.
Very true. Now, Porsche's brief IndyCar program was led by you, and I remember that beautiful green and white car very much. Mm. Highlight of which was Teo Fabi winning at Mid-Ohio in 1989. How special was that win for you and your team, and why did Porsche pull out the following season?
Well, it was very special because I originally left Penske's to join Al Hulbert and be part of his team as a team owner or a small partner, and that didn't work, and so I stayed on to help the Porsche program. So to win, having been at Penske's for so many years, it was a very special win to experience. As to why did Porsche pull out, I think there was changes at the head of the company that decided that perhaps Porsche would be better served in Formula One, and so the direction was to go to Formula One. And also, I think there was a little bit of bittersweet there when the Champ Car, or CART as it was then, changed the rules and basically ruined the Porsche IndyCar in 1990. Car, it ruined that car because that car was a full carbon fiber chassis, which the rules allowed. And when the owners finally woke up and realized that Porsche was making a carbon chassis, they quickly changed the rules and disallowed it for a year, that allowing them all to have time to come out with a carbon fiber chassis. Well, that meant that 90 car was too heavy, was not designed to be a aluminum chassis, carbon honeycomb chassis. It was meant to be a full carbon chassis. And so the whole thing was just downhill. So there's a lot of bitterness inside Porsche that they'd been cheated. And I have to say, I agree with them. I think that was a devastating blow, and one that I think the owners of CART really shouldn't want to feel very happy about, and shouldn't never have wanted to do that ever again to a competitor, especially somebody as Porsche, because they meant a lot to the series, and it just shows how at that time how short-sighted they were as to the big picture.
In 1991, Willie T. Ribbs made history with your team as the first African-American driver to qualify for Indy 500. I remember there was a lot of drama with blown engines before qualifying.
Be a minute.
What are your memories from that effort, which was funded by Bill Cosby?
Well, it was the start of my dream. I had decided when the Porsche program came to an end that I should start my own race team. And so I was wandering around trying to find a deal, and I met Mr. Willie T. Ribbs, who had a little bit of money from Bill to go race at the Indy 500. And I thought, great, let's go. Let's do it. So it wasn't enough, obviously, to win, to go and race at the 500. A lot of people helped us, Buick being one of them. They loaned us engines and all kinds of things. People helped to try and make it possible for Willie to do the race. And on the last qualifying attempt of the last day of qualifying at the Indy 500, Willie put it in the field and became the first African-American to qualify for the race. So it was a very, very special event. Within a couple of hours of that, I had a call from a guy called Ed Renzi, who I had met at Penske's, who used to come as a guest to Rogers. And Ed was the president of McDonald's, and they said, hey, can we put a little bit of a logo on the side of your car? So we were pretty happy to be the first team, first racing to ever have got the golden arches on our race car. So we had little golden arches on there, and Willie started the race. And unfortunately, the old engine didn't last long enough, and we had to retire early.
Now, for putting the logo, did you ask them, do you want fries with that?
No, I should have. What I should have said is, now I'm going to get fries for the rest of my life, right?
Good. Okay, because of time, I'll ask you a few more questions. Do you think we have passed the point of no return on merging the series?
No, I would never say never on that. I think it's the fact of the matter is both series need each other. What is missing is the leadership or the ability for the current leadership to see a common series that can work together. I'm not criticizing them for that. It's a very complicated thing to merge the series. But I think as long as both series need each other and they're both racing the way we are right now, there will always be the door open for unification and in some form. And it can happen in different forms. It doesn't have to be one series. It can be a combination that can come together, which may lead to one series.
Well, as a racing fan, I'm happy to hear that. And finally, how about a message for our listeners, please?
Well, I hope your listeners become watchers. I think the Champ Car Series is one of the best series in the world. I've been in sports cars, I've been in Formula One, and I've been in the IRL too. But I think the Open Wheel Champ Car Series is one of the best race cars and one of the best series. We need to make it better, and one of the ways we can make it better is to increase our audience. So the more people that watch us, the more effective we're going to be at making it better, and I just hope they come and check it out, because it's good racing.
Derek Walker, thank you very much.
Mr. Derek Walker, thank you very much for joining F1 Weekly.
And here's this week's F1Weekly.com trivia answer. The first driver to become world champion, powered by a turbocharged engine, was Nelson Piquet, who in 1983 drove a BMW-powered Brabham to win the world championship. Jean-Pierre Jabouille was the first driver to win a race powered by a turbocharged engine, winning the 1979 French Grand Prix for the Renault team. Okay, talk to you again next week. Bye now.
Hi, I'm Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
And now let's go right to the wrap-up. San Francisco Formula One group. They meet, they drink, and they have a great time during the Formula One season. Check them out at sff1.com. Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRG karts, engines and parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, contact CameronKarting.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and make us a friend or simply like us. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email me at info@F1Weekly.com. I want to thank everybody who listens to the program. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.